This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for this episode, Christopher Rose. In the 1920s, after the First World War, Cairo, Egypt, was one of the hubs of world nightlife and entertainment. Reports in the press tabloids would detail the glamorous goings-on at nightclubs, cabarets, vaudeville performances by a growing number of female performers who took to the stage every night. Their infamy, fame, and fortune grew along with the tabloid press, some of which was actually founded and run by the women themselves. This infamous, if now not widely known, period of Egyptian history is brought to life in Raphael Cormack's Midnight in Cairo's The Divas of Egypt's Roaring Twenties, out now from W.W. Norton Press in arrangement with Saki Books. Here's my interview with Raf Cormack about his book. Raphael Cormack, welcome to New Books Network. Our traditional first question is about you. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you're from, your academic background, and what led you in the direction of this project in the first place?
So I don't have a sort of traditional background in Middle Eastern studies. I'm from the UK, grew up there. And my undergraduate degree was actually in Latin and Greek. So I spent a lot of time reading Greek tragedies and Roman history and that kind of stuff. What actually turned me towards Arabic was going to Khartoum on a family trip to visit my sister who was staying there. And I'd never really, you know, as a kid growing up in the UK, I'd had that much exposure to Arabic culture and literature. I got very interested in it, started learning Arabic in my last year at university, just picked it up in some private courses. Then 2009, went to Cairo. There was a choice back in, you know, back in that time, people always said you either went to Cairo or Damascus to learn Arabic. I decided to go to Cairo. And I just really loved it. I got on with the city a lot. I found it was really kind of fascinating and vibrant and whatever else you want to say. I mean, you could say a lot of things about Cairo, but it certainly makes an impression. So I decided to stay on there, and I spent a year at the AUC learning Arabic, did an MA in Middle Eastern Studies, and then, and I'm getting to why this is important for this book, and then I did a PhD in Edinburgh in Egyptian theater, really, and I tried to kind of bring in the experience I'd had learning, you know, Greek tragedy and reading all of the classical texts. So my PhD was in the adaptations of Oedipus that were done in 20th century Egypt, translations and adaptations into Arabic. So we're talking sort of a lot of the greats of really Arabic theatrical literature of the 20th century, Taha Hussein, Tawfiq al-Hakim, various other, George Abiad, the famous actor, did a great Oedipus. It was quite a Arabic theatre in the 20th century, and particularly these adaptations of Greek tragedies were reasonably highbrow, leaning towards a very, very literate audience. I mean, this was a time when Tawfiq al-Hakim was adapting Oedipus. This was a time when he was not even really performing his plays to an audience, because some of the plays that he performed to audiences had done so badly. And so I, you know, that's what I did my PhD on, those kind of plays. Also looking at how Greek culture in general was received in Egypt in the 20th century, ancient Greek culture, and how it contributed to the kind of growing nationalism of the 20th century, anti-colonialism, all of this kind of thing. So you might be asking, so why did I write this book now on the nightclub divas of Cairo? And the answer is really, well, when it came to the end of my PhD, I couldn't really find a way that I wanted to turn this into a book. I mean, I really enjoy it. I think there's some really great texts there and some really interesting things being done. But all of it seemed to just be, a lot of my arguments were repeating arguments that I felt people had made before, particularly in, you know, where, you know, different cultures had come and mixed in Egypt in the early 20th century. I'm thinking, you know, the Arabic Freud. I'm also thinking about Margaret Litvin's book about Hamlet in Arabic, and various other, I mean, about 5 years ago, lots of people were putting out these books, which sort of saying, you know, lots of different cultural influences came together in Egypt and were turned into something new. I couldn't think really of any way to get beyond that. And really what happened instead is I got very interested in the scene that kind of Tawfiq al-Hakim was ignoring or, you know, sidestepping, and a scene that seemed much more vital and interesting, which is the sort of the more popular theatre that mixed with singing and dancing and all of this kind of stuff in the 1920s and 30s in Egypt, the same time these sort of elite literary figures were adapting their Oedipuses, other people on stages were putting on farces and were doing cabaret shows, nightclub dances, and all the rest of it. That kind of area seemed not only more exciting, but also there was something which I'd always been told really didn't feature in a lot of early 20th century Arabic literary production, which was women at the center of everything.
And I appreciate the book on that level, because there really isn't a lot about this sort of vernacular performance, I guess I would say. There's been a lot of focus on the sort of more elite literati, but Midnight in Cairo, The Divas of Egypt's Roaring Twenties, you know, I think the title sort of encapsulates it all. So can you sort of set the stage for us, what this moment in Cairo after the First World War looked like and why it was such a vibrant time for this sort of performance?
Yeah, and I think what we really need to bear in mind is, of course, the political situation of what's going on. So I always like to start with the 1919 revolution, which, of course, many people will know a lot about. And you know, actually, as you were just saying, although there's not been an enormous amount of work on this vernacular performance, obviously, in the context of the 1919 revolution, Ziad Fahmy's book on ordinary Egyptians is really, really kind of set the field alight. So 1919, to extremely briefly sum it up, the British are at this point officially occupying Egypt and are in control. When the First World War ends, after a lot of privations in various different ways, something that you know probably more about than me. When the First World War ends, Egyptians start thinking that maybe they, like many of the rest of the world, ought to have an independent state. But the British, in short, don't allow them to do it. Then there's a large revolution. People rise up and people take to the streets. They're met with violence. But eventually, kind of after lots of back and forth, they manage to succeed and get an independent country, albeit lots of strings attached. And whereas, so Ziad Fahmy, for instance, focused a lot more on that moment of the 1919 revolution, what my book kind of tries to do is say, okay, what happened after then? You know, now Egypt has this independent country. They have a real kind of sense of national progress being possible, progress, in fact, in general being possible. So this is a time when feminism really starts to be discussed a lot in Egypt. It's also a time when socialism starts to be discussed a lot in Egypt and various other social things. There's a kind of a real sense that the future can be in the hands of ordinary people. So politically, this is like is an extremely exciting time. Couple that with good economic situation in Egypt and also comparatively to much of the rest of, say, Eastern Europe, which is going through extremely tough financial times, Egypt becomes somewhat of a magnet for people on the make, people coming from Europe, people coming from elsewhere in the Middle East. So Cairo particularly becomes not just a really politically interesting place, but a place where lots of people are coming together. And it's in this kind of ferment that a nightclub scene and an entertainment scene, which has been growing since the 19th century, really comes into what people now see as a golden age. And so this was the kind of story that I wanted to tell in the book. What was it like to be in Egypt at that time, particularly as maybe we'll go on to talk about, through the eyes of the women who were particularly prominent and powerful and who directed a lot of what was happening.
Yeah, one of the arguments that you make is that the conventional history of early 20th century Egyptian feminism, which you've already brought up, you know, tends to revolve around the elites and the upper classes. You know, there's that probably apocryphal story of Huda al-Sharawi, you know, tossing her veil into the sea as she docks in Alexandria, or possibly it was at the train station in Cairo. The setting seems to shift. But you argue that there's another history of Egyptian feminism, and I'll quote you here, being written on the stages of Cairo's nightclubs, theaters, and cabarets, end quote. Can you touch a little bit more on how you see this sort of second tier feminism fitting into the larger narrative?
Yeah, and it's a very difficult question to answer, and it's a very complex one when I try to sort of tease out various narratives of in the book. I think so. When we've had the 1919 revolution, famous women's protests also within that, there is undoubtedly an extremely important and influential elite feminist movement, if we want to call it that, at least, or mainstream feminist movement that a lot of people have written about. Huda al-Sharawi, obviously the most prominent figure, but you know, there are many others. And I didn't want to, in the book, I certainly didn't want to say that this is not an important thing. You'd be sort of crazy to say that. But what I noticed really was there are all these other extremely prominent and influential and independent women who are rising at this time. And why haven't we kind of heard about them in this context? Why have they not been written into this story? And, you know, there it's not for lack of material. You go to, and a lot of what I wrote in this book is based on the entertainment magazines of the 1920s and the sort of the gossip press of the 1920s. And you go there, their stories are everywhere. The stories are all over it. It's not because we don't know about these women, but that for some reason they have not been written into the story. And what I want to do is say they should be. I mean, here are people largely with very little formal education, often from pretty at least lower middle class families, if not working class families. You know, not the kind of people who often feature in histories of the early 20th century and before, but here they are, their stories are everywhere. And they are taking control of their lives in various different ways. Many of them, Badia Mosumni, for instance, goes on to own her own cabaret, exert a lot of her own, you know, financial independence, and say pretty, what would be considered pretty progressive things. So Badia Mosumni, who is born herself in Damascus, and whose father dies very young, her family sinks into pretty serious poverty, and she herself experiences sexual abuse at a very young age, comes to Cairo in the 1920s, sets up a cabaret, is briefly married to another actor, Nagiba Raheni, but divorces him, and then lives from the late 1920s until really the 1950s an extremely independent life, and writes in magazines, you know, that she doesn't want to get married because a woman's life ought to be, you know, ought not to be held back by being married to a man. You know, a pretty progressive thing anywhere in the world for the 1920s and 30s. So what I wanted to partly do is put these stories and these viewpoints, you know, lay them out, and also ask why they haven't been included in the canon of feminism, Egyptian feminism of the early 20th century. And I mean, this I don't answer specifically in the book because I don't have a specific answer, but if I were to speculate right now, there's two possible reasons. One, you know, from opposite ends of a spectrum. So one is that you could say people in elite feminism in Egypt was still extremely class bound and rather looked down on a lot of these women who were actresses making their money from a, you know, not a respectable business. And there's shades of this in one of the stories that I tell in the book of Fatima Siri, and it's maybe much too complicated to get into in that much detail, but essentially she has a love affair with Hodashah Rawi's son, which results in the birth of a child, which he then basically disowns, refuses to acknowledge, refuses to pay child support for, and leaves her on her own. She takes the fights to the courts, supported by the money that she's made singing and releasing records, and eventually wins and gets the child acknowledged as his legitimate son, and he has to pay child support, and then it's incorporated into the Shahrawi family. And while this whole court case is going on, Fatima Siri suspects that Hoda Shahrawi, the great Egyptian feminist who, as Fatima Siri says, is filling up magazines with all her talk of women's equality, Fatima Siri suspects that Hoda Shahrawi, while they look down on her because she's an actress, doesn't want her son to be married to this sort of woman of a lower social status, and therefore tries to sabotage the relationship. Now, we don't have Hoda Shahrawi's side, so it's a little hard to weigh these up, but it does seem to suggest that some people within elite feminist circles did not want to include actresses, singers, dancers in their movement. So that's one possible reason why these women have not been included in the canon. To come at it from another angle, I mean, there are also ways that you could look at the lives of these women and question how feminist their kind of existence was. And this is something that's very hard to know, but, you know, they were making their money in an extremely patriarchal business, and in they had to deal on a day-to-day basis with the patriarchy, and they had to make all kinds of bargains. They were, you know, sexualized. So to hold up the nightclub industry as this kind of paragon of feminism feels slightly uncomfortable, because it's clearly such an industry that is built on misogyny in a certain way, or at least the exploitation of women. So maybe that's another mm-hmm. reason why people feel uncomfortable including these kind of lives in a history of feminism. So, I mean, that's just two speculations, but I think whatever way you look at it, there's some extremely interesting and important details of women's lives in the 1920s and onwards, which have been rather overlooked.
I think that sort of discomfort, is an important part of the story. The performers you write about really function on the edge of society and often transgress its rules and push the boundaries of what was considered socially acceptable. And many of them were quite successful as a result of having done so. So how were these women, because most of them, as you've already described, came from much more humble backgrounds, how were they able to walk this line successfully?
It's very difficult to say. I mean, so a few of these women, I mean, I think particularly of Munir al-Mahdaya, really made their celebrity by the transgression. And the transgression was something that they didn't try and hide in any way. If anything, it was something they tried to play up. So Munir al-Mahdaya would hold these extremely lavish parties on her houseboat. She was known as, the greatest poker player in Egypt, would drink, all the finest whiskies and brandies, and would clearly attempt to construct an image for herself as a sort of decadent and almost debauched, certainly transgressive figure. Another thing that she would frequently do would be dress up in male clothing, have photo shoots, mm-hmm. and send that into the newspapers, clearly as a kind of act of transgression of gender norms in some way. Exactly what's going on, we can debate, but it's clearly she's playing it up and wanting the press to know that she's doing it. So how, it's a difficult question. How do we square that with all the rest of what we know that, say, for instance, performance on stage is seen as something very close to sex work in a sort of polite society. Mm-hmm. There are certainly reports that extremely strongly suggest that in cabarets, at least, if not necessarily in theatres, in cabarets, the female performers were sexually available to men in the audience. There are reports, sometimes that I remember reading one very, very recently, which didn't make it into the book because I read it after I published it, but just saying that, some nightclub had been busted because the women had sexually transmitted diseases, therefore obviously suggesting that prostitution was going on in that cabaret. But even without the sort of specifics of sex work, performance on stages, particularly in the 1910s and 20s, was seen as close to sex work, even if sex work wasn't going on. So how do we square the fact that these are extremely transgressive things that are going on, often rather looked down on by society, and that instead of trying to sort of cover that up, some people are leaning into it, but still remaining these global celebrities. And Munir al-Mahdaya, although, I mean, I don't think there's any suggestion that she was involved in sex work, she certainly plays up her transgressive role and is a massive star, not only in Egypt, also across the entire Arab world. And this part of it gets to this question about feminism too, because there is one argument in telling the lives of women like this, and the lives of celebrity women who are sort of exceptional. One argument goes that a few people are given this exceptional status as kind of a lightning rod for everyone else. So Munir al-Mahdeya is out there being extremely transgressive, kind of in order for the rest of society not to be having to do that. Here she is in all the newspapers, in the in the magazines, playing the bad girl, so that the nice women at home say can watch her on stage, but then go home and sort of have some kind of purification of that. I mean, that's what I actually don't buy that as an argument. I don't think that's true. I think it's just the mere fact of her public existence and saying some pretty radical things is enough to make her important. And, you know, even if a woman at home is merely fantasizing about the possibility of being Munir al-Mahdeya without actually doing it, that's still kind of an important thing. But I could see the argument that if you have some of these extremely prominent celebrity women, they act as sort of a safety valve on the rest of society. So, so it's hard to know exactly what's going on when clearly a lot of these women are making their career on transgressing societal norms, which again is, you know, something we're sort of told ought not to happen in the early 20th century, but it does.
In my own research, because I'm coming at it from the public health angle, but I've definitely seen it referred to in a number of documents published through the police or the military authorities that nightclubs, it's pretty much a given in their minds that any woman who performs on stage is supplementing her income through sex work, but it's much more complicated than that. But at the same time, you can't separate this life in the nightclub from that aspect. And then also the sort of inevitable association of public performance with organized crime as well. Gambling, sort of underground activities. How did that frame this aspect of performance? Did it make it more sort of dangerously fantastical or tarnish it in any way?
Yeah, it's definitely a major context. And one of the things also which I found so interesting in writing this book is this whole space of Ezbekeia from the 19th century, the nightlife district, which sort of, I guess, gets going as what we would see as a modern nightlife district in the 1870s, 80s, to a serious way. There'd been entertainment there before, but as a place with theatres and cabarets and so forth, gets going around the 1870s and then becomes this kind of area which comes to signify so much in the sort of public consciousness of Egyptians. I'm thinking partly of Joseph Prestel's book about Berlin and Cairo in the 1890s, mm-hmm. when he talks about how by that point Ezbekeia has become this kind of cipher for all the things that you're talking about: gambling, prostitution, essentially corrupting the youth of Egypt. And that's a thing that keeps going throughout the 1900s, 10s and 20s. And this whole geographical area with everything butting up against each other. So there is a red light district in Ezbekeia, very close to, a sort of British sanctioned couple of roads that start to get going in the late 19th century. There are hashish dens, there are gambling houses, next to theatres, next to the high class opera house where the royal family or the Khedivial family would go and see European performances. Everything is kind of butting up against each other in this reasonably small area of Cairo, and how that all worked together, it is very interesting, and how that was sort of both how all these different things under the extremely broad title of entertainment, from gambling to theater to prostitution, all came together in the same place, and then how that area took on its sort of own life in Egyptian public consciousness of, you know, a place where people went to throw their money away and, you know, lose their virtue and all of those things. And you see it keep going really, you know, into the films of the 1940s and 50s, where they have these scenes in the nightclubs of the wealthy young Bachelorette, you know, spending their money on too much booze and seeing the nightclub performances. That's a real image that keeps going for a very long time, and how it's all thrown together in this one area is very fascinating, and how that area worked itself was something that I already had a lot of fun diving into.
Yeah, it was definitely, this entire area was so concerning to the military officials. And of course you talk about the so-called Battle of the Wazir, which takes place right in the middle of this, which is the Australian soldiers sort of going on a bit of a brawl in the middle of the red light district, and then the area really becomes quite infamous.
Yeah, and I my interpretation, so in the First World War, Cairo becomes this big center of British and as well, you know, allied, because it's not only Brits, it's anyone fighting in, you know, the allied or whatever we call it, armies. And Cairo becomes this center, not where people fight, but where they go and take a break, which usually means going out and getting very drunk, causing an enormous amount of trouble. And, you know, still in Egyptian culture, you know, people remember how, you know, people always talk about how the Australians came in and caused so many problems. You know, it's in Naguib Mahfouz. It's everywhere. This kind of thing is a, this reputation remains. But what was interesting to me was what effect this really had on the nightlife of Cairo. One of my arguments in the book, which I don't push that far, but I would be interested to, is that it really totally changed Cairo's nightlife, because the Brits are so worried about their soldiers being corrupted or whatever it is, that they force the nightclubs to close down, they either have to close down by 10 p.m. or stop serving alcohol. So essentially they have to close down by 10 p.m. and no one's going to go to a nightclub before then anyway, so they all close down. And it's after this happens, very quickly after this happens, that all of these vaudeville and revue theaters rise. So, you know, it's just after the nightclubs get closed down that Naguib Errahani starts really getting success with his Kish Kish Bey character, and then Ali Alcazar comes along. It's just after the nightclubs close down that Mundir El Mateya switches to performing on the stage. So this whole genre of vaudeville theatre, which later takes Cairo in the late 1910s and early 20s by storm, and moves on to become this kind of revue theatre mix, Franco-Arab revue of comic plays and songs, which is really extremely influential. I mean, I would tie its rise to the close of the nightclubs, which come because the British authorities are so terrified of the nightclubs. So it's an interesting sort of little butterfly effect kind of story.
Yeah, and they also are never able to close it down. They try repeatedly to move everything to the outskirts of town, and it won't take. It's a remarkably resilient area. And the people who work there as well. So as the stories progress, the fame and the notoriety of these performers is enhanced through recording technology and the press. I really want to talk for a second here about Ruzul Yusuf, who is both a female performer who then founds a publication dedicated to the arts that becomes extraordinarily influential in the Egyptian press in the 1920s. How did this publication in particular really sort of changed the landscape of media and performance and its success, acceptability in broader society.
It's Rosal Yusuf's entire story is an amazing encapsulation of the Esbekeh dream, if you want to call it that, the possibilities that actually were becoming available to women at this time through entertainment. So she, like so many women of the period, she starts off her life in pretty extreme poverty. Her very early life is a little bit hard to know about, but we do know she arrives in Egypt essentially alone as a girl of around 10, 11 or 12 with no money, with nothing, fetches up in Esbekeh and over a number of years develops into one of the great female stars of the theater. She starts first as a sort of vaudeville actress and then she moves into more sort of melodramas and dramas with Yusuf Wahbi's theatre troupe. And she, by the mid-1920s, she's reached pretty much the pinnacle of any career you can reach, which in itself, okay, is great. She's come from nothing and reached the pinnacle of an acting career. But what she then does is switch on a dime almost into the world of journalism, and she tells you the story of exactly how she does that has been told by a number of people from different angles, and they all basically agree that it's a summer in Cairo in the mid-1920s. She's sitting in a cafe talking with some of her friends about the basic entertainment magazine scene, and we'll go a little bit into that later, but in this period, it's extremely vibrant. Lots of magazines are starting up, lots are closing down. Often they're filled with little bits of gossip. Often the veracity of the gossip is a little hard to confirm. But people are eating them up, and one person will start one and it'll run for a year and start again. Rosal Yusuf decides, one, that none of these magazines are really taking acting and art very seriously, and two, that also a lot of these magazines don't particularly like her. I think that's one motivation for starting her own magazine, is she's been so unfairly treated in other magazines. So she decides she's going to start her own, which, I mean, as I say, lots of people are sort of deciding at the time. But what makes hers different is that she turns it into this massive success. Clearly, with a lot of hard work, she really gets out there and gets the subscriptions. But faces also quite a bit of backlash. As we were saying before, the profession of actress is not respected. And there are a number of people, she tells stories of, for instance, going up to try and get a subscription from a doctor who lives in central Cairo. And he says, he would love to read the magazine, but he doesn't think he could really hold his head high, kind of, if he had a magazine, an acting magazine, published by an actress, delivered to his house. So there's pushback against her too, but she fights and so forth, and really puts a lot of work into it, and the magazine becomes a massive success, keeps going, as a lot of people know, till this day. I mean, Rosal Yusuf, the publishing house and the newspaper, still survives, even long after her death. But in the late 1920s and early 1930s, she really is riding high on a wave of success and popularity. And the magazine becomes very important, not only politically, it's very pro, very anti-colonial, like pro-independence, pro-weft magazine when it starts. But also brings a lot of, as you say, brings a lot of this entertainment scene much more into the mainstream. So her life is kind of, with a few bumps along the way, really the model of what can happen, what opportunities were available for women in this period, what you could do with little education, you know, some ambition and an opening field of opportunity. A woman could run her own magazine and it could become successful and financially viable. And even though a few people might make comments here and there, now was a time when it was becoming, possible.
One of the sort of controversial these days top ways to describe Egyptian society of the early 20th century is to refer to it as cosmopolitan. I'm just curious to know where you stand on that and how you feel that this entire industry fits into the larger picture.
Yeah, I've had a lot of back and forth and thinking about this whole idea of cosmopolitanism in Egypt, which is so strong, not only in Egypt itself, but also, you know, in the UK too. There's this kind of misty-eyed romanticism for this time in the 20s and 30s and maybe before, a time which, you know, I think it's not unfair to say that there's a sort of colonial nostalgia about that too in the UK. But it's not only there, you know, also in Egypt there is this idea that back then everyone was living together and was getting on great, and Muslims, Jews and Christians and Europeans and everyone, and they came together and it was this kind of utopian society. Obviously, you know, I think looking at it closer, it was no utopia. I mean, it was no utopia for women, but it was also no utopia in general. The power differentials, the colonial politics, I don't think we need to entirely go into that. But one thing that kind of inspired me to delve more into this scene was writing by people like Khaled Fahmy, who says not so much that, okay, this cosmopolitan utopia was a myth, which he does say, but he says, okay, when we look for cosmopolitanism, why do we need to look in these elite European circles? Why do we need to look in, you know, the Darrell, the Kavafi, the Forster, kind of, they're always the big three who are held up, you know, actually very, very different. all three of them had pretty different engagements with cosmopolitanism, but Khaled Fahmy's writing it, you know, he says, well, okay, let's look at some other places in Alexandria and see that actually these could just as easily be called cosmopolitan as could, you know, the European quote unquote areas. And I think generally my feeling is that you can say the same about the nightlife district and nightlife scene of Cairo. This could just as easily be called cosmopolitan, but it's a very different kind of diversity of power relations. You know, well, you know, for one, this is an Arabic speaking kind of milieu, at least the one that I was looking at. There are other performance traditions which are which are not, you know, you could go to the opera house and that's largely European troops performing to European and elite audiences. But if you go to Nagib El-Rehani's plays, or if you go to Fatma Rushdie's plays, Yusuf Wasbi or so on, these are extremely diverse, both audiences and performers, you know, not only of Muslims, Christians, Jews, people from Shem, people from North Africa, Europeans also performing in an Arabic-speaking milieu. So one thing which I try to say is here, you know, as we did with feminism, is like here is another story that you can tell about feminism in Egypt in the 1920s and 30s. Here also is another kind of story that we can tell about cosmopolitanism in the 1920s and 30s. Again, like feminism, not a perfect one, not a utopia. There's still power differentials here. You know, a lot of the people who own the theaters tended to be European, say, and you know, so there's that dynamic going on, but it's certainly a different dynamic than the one that we've seen before, and in that sense, very interesting.
Shifting gears just a little bit, coming out of academia, how was it writing a book geared for a more popular audience?
It was, like I said, my PhD, I somehow couldn't turn it into a book. I'm not entirely sure why, partly because I felt I wasn't saying anything new, but partly because just the style of academic writing and the style of popular writing is so different. And I mean, this is a big debate. Many people have talked about it. I am not of the opinion that academic writing is all bad. I think, although some people might be, I'm not. I mean, there is bad academic writing. There's also a lot of bad non-academic writing. there's some academic books are unquestionably fantastically well written, but the style of it is very different. And it was interesting trying to kind of making that shift for me, making a shift in which everything is kind of guided by the narrative much more than it's guided by the argument. And you have to have a sense of what the argument is. But the moment you start trying to make an argument, the editor will cross it out. Like, okay, no, don't, none of this academic stuff. You have to make the narrative in a way kind of encompass the argument, which is sometimes, more fun to read and write, but it has to be said, it sometimes leaves out room for the kind of complexity that academic writing can hold. So I found myself a lot of the time writing on the one hand this and this and this, but actually maybe this and this and this, and then trying to balance it out. And then when you come to the end, you just have to cross out all of the caveats and complexities, somewhat, not necessarily complexity, but the caveats and the but on the other hands, and just hope that it all makes sense in the end, and you hope that kind of the fact of having written out those caveats and then crossed them out is somehow maintained in the writing. But I found it sometimes difficult, but very fun. And of course, the other thing to consider is when writing for an audience which is not necessarily academic, you have to be much broader in both the things that you bring up. You have to explain more on the one hand, but you have to balance things a lot. So one thing that for me in the writing of this book was a difficult balancing act was in Anglo-American sort of European popular culture, this is a nightclub scene, this is an entertainment scene that I think the majority of people have no idea even ever existed. In Egypt, people obviously know it existed, and it meant a lot to some people. Some people today still really know a lot about this scene and are products. The entertainment industry in Egypt is a product of this scene in the 1920s and 30s, somewhat altered, but certainly the DNA of it is in there. So how to balance both trying to speak to an Egyptian audience who has a big connection with this and speak to a Western audience who doesn't even know that, Munira Al-Mahdaya ever existed or who she was. I'm not sure exactly how I balanced it, but it was fun trying.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a fun read actually. Because like I said, I think this is, something that a lot of us are aware of, but I don't think we're familiar with the intricacies and just how socially important a lot of what you're discussing here really was at the time, and what kind of a following a number of these performers had, with the exception of, for example, Umm Kulsum, because she went on to become the star of the entire Arab world, but certainly many of the others are just names.
one
hears occasionally.
And I hope if I've you know added something to for the Egyptian reader, it is those intricacies and how everything really ties together. So, you know, in writing this book, we've talked a few times already in this interview about the entertainment magazine scene and, you know, the recording scene too. So part of this reason I think that the 1920s and 30s is such an important time is not only because it was a massive scene, but because it is so well documented in these magazines and in these records. And sort of for the first time, there's a kind of public celebrity culture when people are picking up on their newsstand interviews with the stars of the time and looking at articles that look into the houses of the stars at the time and what they ate for breakfast and all the rest of it, which just wasn't going on in the 1890s, but in the 1920s it is. And I had a lot of fun. I could endlessly just read these entertainment magazines and look through the stories and yeah, I think particularly for the Egyptian reader who will know some of these names but not necessarily know all of these details, the thing that I hope to have added is really an extremely close, in-depth engagement with all these gossip rags, basically.
Yeah, yeah. So our traditional final question, what are you working on now?
I'm taking a slight side turn, but not as much of a side turn as you might think. I'm working on a book on spiritualism in the Middle East.
Spiritualism. Okay.
Globally, but particularly in the Middle East. And it did come out of this project because when reading these magazines, I noticed just how many sort of spiritualist acts and hypnotist acts and mind reading acts were also playing at the same time as the, you know, in the interval between a play, there would be a spiritualist act in Cairo in the 20s and 30s. And I started delving into some of these people, one of whom really particularly stands out is this guy called Dr. Dervish, who was performing a little bit in Egypt in the 1930s, but made a name for himself in Lebanon in the 1940s, sort of starting his own religion. He called it a message, actually. And actually, I just found out that someone in Egypt has published a sort of novel about him, which I've read a little bit of, but actually can't bring myself to read the whole thing until I've finished this piece of work, mm-hmm. because it'll just get in the way too much. But some people are interested in him, but not many people really know about him. And then looking into his life, I found this whole history of spiritualism in the Arab world, but also kind of interacting with Europe and America, this whole other world, which I've been delving into as well, and that's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, that sounds fascinating, and I can't wait to read it. Okay, Midnight in Cairo: The Divas of Egypt's Roaring Twenties is out now from W.W. Norton Press in arrangement with Saki Books. Raphael Cormack, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.